The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of Salem Media of Hawaii.
Welcome to Hawaii's Tomorrow. Coming up today, Jeff meets with newsmakers, shares breaking news, spotlights top community activities and leaders. He'll keep you ahead of the news and informed as you make your way home today. So join Jeff Davis right here, right now, and every day at 5. So stay tuned and you'll have something to talk about over dinner tonight with Hawaii's Tomorrow today. That's Hawaii's Tomorrow today.
Aloha! Yes, it's me, Braden Avas. My friends and I are taught cooperation in school. Can you grown-ups please cooperate? We need to work together for our environment. Mahalo. Take it, solar guy!
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal on this Tuesday, June 3rd. And I am really excited for today's show, which is honoring World Ocean Day. World Ocean Day is coming up this Sunday, June 8th, although I personally believe every day should be World Ocean Day. And in order to honor this special event, we have some of Hawaii's leading researchers to talk with us about their amazing science and how they honor our ocean planet. First up is Dr. Megan Donahue, Associate Researcher at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, University of Hawaii. She focuses on spatial population dynamics in marine systems. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carly.
So, first, let's break down spatial dynamics or spatial population dynamics. That is a big word. So let's figure out how this happens. Can you give us a little breakdown about what this means?
Sure. Sorry for the jargony description of my research. What I study is basically we look at how different critters that live in the ocean, how they grow and reproduce differently in different places. So that gives us an idea of So for instance, thinking about a particular project I have going on right now is looking at coral around Maui. And at different sites on Maui, we're looking at a couple of the really common species of coral, finger coral and rice coral that your listeners might be familiar with. And those guys are growing at one site. They might grow faster, at one site slower. And we want to know kind of what are the things that impact that growth rate and what are the effects of that on their populations.
That is amazing. I love to know a little bit more about this. So you're looking at the different growth rates. What kind of things are you finding that affect different corals?
Sure. So some of the common things to think about when you're thinking about how corals do in our environment here in Hawaii are how close they are to shore. So the depth that they're at, the depth they're at influences how much light they receive. And of course, they have little algae that live inside them that help them make a living, and so the depth determines their light, how much light they get, and that determines their growth rate. There's some other factors too, more important. The amount of sediment that that humans put in the ocean in the near shore environment can definitely influence coral success too.
So are you only working with corals, or are there other ecosystems or species that you work with in your research?
So here in Hawaii, we're doing some work on coral, like I said. But we've also got some interesting projects looking at bioerosion rates around the islands here. And bioerosion is a really interesting process. When we think about the coral reefs that kind of fringe the islands of Hawaii, those coral reefs are obviously the corals themselves are building up the reefs and laying down the calcium carbonate that we see out there when we walk on the near shore. But there's a lot of other organisms that are breaking down that coral reef. So there's little worms and little mollusks or mussels and clams that bore into the coral reef, and they actually kind of hollow it out. And over time, it makes the reef kind of susceptible to things like really strong waves. So when we have a really big south swell, maybe that now hollowed out reef is going to kind of crumble under that south swell. So we have this really dynamic process. Although when we go out on a day-to-day basis, the reef looks like it's staying the same. Over a longer time period, the coral is building up that reef and these little bioeroders are breaking it down. And those are just the ones that live inside the reef. There's also critters like the parrotfish or urchins that, you know, we see a lot and the kind of that we notice. And those guys are also chewing on the reef and taking out the kind of scraping off little bits of the coral skeleton. So that really dynamic process is another part of what my lab works on.
That's so interesting how it's all related. Now, you do a lot of modeling as well with your work. How does that fit into the bigger picture?
Yeah, so so that's kind of my area of expertise, is kind of figuring out how to measure these processes in a way that we can write equations to describe them. And that sounds like a little bit scary, but it's not. What it allows us to do is say, okay, so this particular species, say of coral, in this particular environment grows so fast, but in another environment it grows maybe a little bit slower. And once we can actually describe that relationship, then we can not only say, then we can actually predict if the environment changes in a way, then we can say how fast is it going to grow in that future environment. So by actually being able to model and quantify those relationships between, say, species like a coral growth rate and its environment, or coral reproduction rate and its environment, then we can actually look at what's going to happen in the future as we change that environment through global climate change or through other anthropogenic impacts or natural impacts on the environment.
So are you looking at this only in Hawaii, or are there other locations globally that you're looking at?
So I've worked in a few different areas. Certainly in my Since moving to Hawaii, my research focus is here, right in our backyard, because it's such a great place to work and do marine biology. I've also worked and have some ongoing work in the California coastal environment, where I've done some work in the kelp forests in Southern California and a lot of intertidal work in Northern California. So looking at there, the intertidal is a really dynamic system. Here we have a pretty nifty intertidal here too. We've got cool opihi and our little helmet urchins and a really neat environment. But in the kind of Northern California and Oregon coasts, the tidal exchange is much, much bigger. So instead of here, we might see a difference of a meter or 3-4 feet between high and low tide. There we might see 8 or 10 or 12 feet difference between high or low tide. So the range is, like, what those organisms experience is much, much bigger. And so it's a really kind of exciting place to work because of that. And then I've also worked in the Atlantic too. So if you think about the East Coast and north near Maine, there's an area called the Gulf of Maine, where that's a big cod fishery is what it's most known for. But there's some little islands off the coast there too, called the Isles of Shoals. And there's some work I've done some work on crabs and other nice intertidal snails and crabs and things like that up there.
So you've been able to experience the full gamut of ocean ecosystems in cold weather versus warm weather environments.
That's right.
So in looking at this erosion and modeling of coral reefs in Hawaii, how fast do Hawaiian corals grow, maybe comparative to other places? Do you know that? Are you able to find that information out from your research?
So it really varies more by species than location. So in our so there are certain kinds of groups of corals that grow very rapidly. So here, those corals are going to be what we sometimes call cauliflower coral or the Passalopera corals. They're small and they look like little spheres and they grow really fast. And rice coral also grows relatively quickly. Some of the other corals, the finger coral or the mounding corals, the parietes, those grow much more slowly. And so those are really much bigger effects than, you know, Hawaii versus, say, you know, the South Pacific. The species level effects are much bigger. And so that is something we focus on, is trying to understand. So in the work around Maui, we're building models of coral growth for several different species. So we'll have a sense of, perhaps a fast-growing species responds much more to sediment stress, but a slower-growing species might, you know, have a much longer time scale of response to different kinds of stressors.
So that might change what types of corals we see or how much of one species we see in future ecosystems as they change with climate change or ocean acidification.
Absolutely. So some of those fast-growing corals are also the ones that are most sensitive to thermal stress. So the montiporids, or in outside of Hawaii, the acroporid species, are the ones that tend to be much more susceptible to thermal stress that we see in the summers, and that we'll see really large bleaching events for those species. And so there is definitely some, as the environment changes, the winters are going to change, and which of those species are most able to respond. So the fast-growing corals are very interesting because they are more sensitive to thermal stress, but they also grow much faster. They recruit much more quickly. And so there's the possibility of recovery. the slower growing species are, well, slower growing, but they're also more bleaching resistant, but they tend to be a little bit less resilient when they have been damaged by bleaching or other stresses. So there is this complex interplay. It's really difficult to predict exactly who's going to be the winner.
Which is where the modeling comes in, right?
Exactly.
And so this research focuses on coral reefs, but a lot of your modeling and stuff has applications for all kinds of organisms and ecosystems. How do you solve ecological problems using these tools?
So there's two things that I think are the kind of are the focus of the modeling work that we work on. One is we started this by trying to say what spatial population dynamics is, right? And part of what I think is really interesting is to say, okay, how do if a species is doing well in one area and poorly in another area, or if humans are going to impact it in one area and less in another area, what does that mean for the population as a whole, as opposed to what's happening to that population in a small location? Like, what is happening at the whole species level? And so trying to scale up from those many, many small-scale impacts or the spatial variation in particular environmental parameters, how does that actually influence what's going on at the larger scale of the whole system? And that's really ultimately, if we're thinking about conserving biodiversity and protecting species for the long term, we need to know what's happening at the level of the whole species. So that's one of the ways that we've really focused on. I think the other thing to think about is we have these models of species-specific response to environmental change. And so that gives us a way to predict which species are going to be winners and losers, or which species will respond more or less to a particular environmental impact. And therefore, we can manage accordingly, and we can avoid certain environmental impacts to help preserve those species.
Excellent. That's so interesting and so such important work, especially in thinking about World Ocean Day and how, you know, we can preserve these species and our oceans. So aside from the fantastic research you do, are you planning on honoring World Ocean Day in another way?
You know, I think I will go and enjoy the ocean just for fun on World Ocean Day, which means my husband and I will go for a snorkel and go and play on one of our great beaches here.
That sounds like an excellent way to honor it. And do you have any advice for others in terms of how they can get involved with marine sciences or similar work to what you do?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it really depends on where you are in life and what you want to do. So certainly for students who are, say, in high school or early college and thinking about what they want to do with their lives, so to speak, you know, there's a lot of great opportunities for summer programs and semester at sea and lots of, Carly, you probably know better than me all of the great educational opportunities available on this island for students at that stage. And then there's just lots of opportunities here kind of with our resources we have at hand. So going to the speaker series at Hanauma Bay and going to the Waikiki Aquarium and taking advantage of all the great educational resources we have.
Well, that's a great answer. And there are so many things going on for World Ocean Day that people can do and get involved with. And we'll talk a little bit about that later on in the show. Dr. Donahue, you are doing some truly interesting work. So thank you very much for taking some time to talk with us today. We're going to take a quick traffic break and learn more about our amazing oceans when we come back with Dr. Ode Pacini. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors, Leakmaster Roofing, Kamayama Solar, Grand Solar, BenQ Solar, and the University of Hawaii Research Corporation.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
A reminder, the exit ramp from Fort Weaver Road southbound that loops around to Farrington Highway eastbound is going to be closed tonight from 10 p.m. until 4 tomorrow morning. We've got the typical slowdowns going west to the stadium, but if you're coming into town from the west, expect slower than usual traffic. It's backed up on both freeways at the Middle Street merge because of that earlier accident before the Punahou exit. It has been cleared. Normal traffic to the windward side and Hawaii Kai.
You want to get solar for all the right reasons, to live greener and get your utility bills under control. But the one thing you don't want is to get stuck. with a solar conversion system that can't keep up with changing electrical rules and regulations. So get a system that's future perfect, one smart enough to let you use all the renewable energy you can produce, plus store the surplus for when you want to use it. That's Outback Power, with exclusive grid hybrid technology backed by legendary support. With an Outback Power system, you can have it all. Net metering when it's available or off-grid independence when it makes the most sense. Contact Outback Power Technologies for an installation specialist near you. If you're unhappy with the high prices or the way you've been treated by mainland corporations, get rid of them. Let Hank's Tax Service help you. Hank and his employees have been preparing taxes in Hawaii for close to 20 years. The sharpest preparers from Hank's 2 decades of unparalleled tax service have rejoined him to serve you, not make money for a mainland corporation. If you're paying over $200, you're paying way too much. Get rid of that mainland corporation and come to Hank's. Hank's Tax Service, 853-1170. 853-1170.
Aloha, this is your solar guy, Jeff Davis here. If you have any questions regarding HECO's new regulations for photovoltaics or solar electric in your neighborhood, as you know, they have new rules, just call me at 554-7200. I'll answer your questions most likely right over the phone, 554-7200. And please don't forget, solar hot water, solar-powered pool pumps, solar heating, all that is good to go. I can handle any of those questions as well. Call your solar guy at 554-7200. Aloha.
Hi, I'm Frank Rogers from Leakmaster Roofing and the Cool Roof Store. We sell and install protective roof coatings for all types of roofs. What kind of roof do you have? For flat roofs, we recommend silicone roof coatings because they withstand unlimited ponding water and they come with a 50-year material warranty. We feature trusted names like Geico, NXT Cool Zone, and Apoc Silicone with some of the lowest prices in town. If you have a Monier roof or a metal roof, we recommend that you recoat them with NXT Cool Zone to make them shine like new. Asphalt shingles can be protected and waterproof for the lifetime of your home with the Cool Roof Store's ceramic coating. Whether you want Leakmaster Roofing to install the coating or want to do it yourself, come on down to our store in Kaka'ako or visit us at leakmaster.com. Why re-roof when you can simply recoat?
Aloha! It's me, Brayden of Us! And again, I ask a favor. Will you help restock the fish on our reefs so when my friends and I go snorkeling, we can see Hawaii as it should be? Mahalo. Thank you, Solar Guy.
Welcome back to the show. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. With us now is Dr. Ode Pacini, assistant researcher in the Marine Mammal Research Program at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Ode, you study ocean sound and how sound affects cetaceans. So first, what are cetaceans?
Cetaceans are dolphins and whales. Yeah. So all the marine mammals that spend their entire life in the ocean.
Excellent. And so how do you study sound on these animals?
Well, I'm primarily interested in hearing. So we use techniques that doctors use with infants and newborns primarily. And we put little sensors on their back and we play sounds and we look for responses from the brain. So, yeah.
Wow. And that's a really unique area of research. What got you interested in this?
Well, I was very interested in the sensory abilities of marine mammals, and we know they rely on sound extensively. A third of their brain is actually dedicated to sound processing. They use sound to forage, communicate, avoid predators, etc. And they have evolved amazing abilities. They use echolocation, tooth whales, so dolphins with teeth, use echolocation. It's the best sonar in the world. There's no man-made sonar that can really compare to a dolphin sonar.
So echolocation, for those of us that aren't 100% familiar with, you know, in a few sentences, can you break that down for us?
Certainly. So dolphins and bats are known to use echolocation. And what they'll do is they produce a sound, and that sound will hit a target. It can be a prey. It can be an obstacle. And that sound will bounce back to the animal. And from that echo, they can interpret the distance, the speed of a target, if it's the fish. And what kind of fish it is. They're actually really, really good at discriminating between objects.
That'd be amazing to be able to see using sound, wouldn't it?
Especially in the ocean, because there is very limited light past 200 meters.
So why are people so concerned around cetaceans and marine mammals and sound?
Well, I think it's not just marine mammals. We're concerned about all marine life. There are people who study the impact of sound on larvae, on fish, and it's important for fisheries, obviously, and all types of marine mammals, so sea lions, seals, etc. Because marine mammals rely so much on sound, if we out sound in the ocean, we're probably compromising some of their abilities to live in the ocean.
So why the resurgence all of a sudden? Is the ocean getting noisier?
The ocean is getting noisier. The ocean is a noisy place to begin with. Fish are loud. Snapping shrimps are really loud. If you're lucky enough to snorkel in Hawaii during the humpback whale season, you'll hear them
They're
sing.
They're very loud.
They are very loud. But there's a lot of man-made sound. It comes from shipping, boat traffic, construction, a lot of pile driving noise. We also have noise from oil exploration and drilling, and finally military activities, and they can be underwater explosions or military sonars.
So, I mean, some of these sounds are biological or natural sounds, some are man-made. How can we tell what is harmful and what's not?
Well, it mostly depends on how loud the sound is, how long the sound is, and what type of frequency, what type of pitch you're looking at. Those are the main parameters that will affect those marine mammals.
And marine mammals have a huge range in their hearing or their pitch, right?
Correct. If you look at dolphins, they can hear up to 160 kilohertz, which is about 8 to 10 times better than we can hear. It's much better than your dog or much better than your cat. They're really, really good listeners.
So are some better than others? Like who has the best hearing? Are humpback whales good or...?
You know, we still don't know what large whales hear. So that's a big mystery. It's kind of the holy grail of what we do. We know that dolphins hear very, very well. Those, so far, are the ones that hear the best. We suspect that mysticetes like humpback whales do not hear as well as dolphins, just because they don't rely on echolocation, and the sounds they produce are lower in frequency, lower in pitch.
And even within dolphins, you know, we have spinner dolphins here, mm-hmm. bottlenose. Is there variations in how well they can hear, or is it about the same?
Well, you know, we're still trying to figure that out because we don't have access to a lot of marine mammals. So trying to make those comparisons is a little too early. We know some animals are very specialized in their hearing, like the beaked whales. We know they hear very specific frequencies, but it's hard to tell across the board if there are major differences.
Now, you just recently did some work in the Philippines.
Correct.
Was this revolving around marine mammal sound?
Yes, it was. We were invited by the Philippine Marine Mammals Trending Network to test the hearing of four animals that stranded in the Philippines following what we think was dynamite fishing. So after the vet assessed the health of the animal, he suspected there was some sort of trauma, and acoustic trauma was most likely. So we were sent there to test the hearing of those animals. And three of them were spinner dolphins, like the one we have here. And out of those four animals, three of them had high-frequency hearing loss, so hearing impairment.
Wow. So is there something that can be done for these animals, or what was the next step after you identified that there was hearing loss?
Well, the next step will be to test their hearing again. Maybe, you know, the hearing will improve over time. They cannot be released. If they can't hear, if they cannot echolocate, they're very unlikely to survive in the wild. So that was the primary goal, is to assess whether or not we could release those animals.
So what will the fate of the animals be now? Will they be cared for? Or?
They will be cared for by the Stranding Network and their collaborators. There are parks there and facilities where they can be housed and taken care of.
And were they able to identify who was doing the dynamite fishing, or is there plans to try and stop some of that in the area?
Well, we are trying. We're trying to work with the local communities to better understand what type of dynamite fishing they're using, how often they're using it. Obviously, it's just not targeting marine mammals. It's targeting the entire ecosystem. So it's a big issue. And we're hoping to do more work there and try to really educate kids and the fishermen that it is extremely unsustainable.
And you have such an interesting job. I mean, not just flying to the Philippines and working with this. You do a lot of stranding work here in Hawaii as well. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
That's correct. So we work in partnership with NOAA and the Stranding Network at HPU. And whenever there is a live animal, we try to go there and we try to test its hearing. And we've been successful several times. We obtained the first hearing measurements of a Beak-12, and that was a couple of years ago, right after RIMPAC. So everybody really wanted to know what that animal heard and if its training was related to RIMPAC.
Wow, and beaked whales are pretty rare.
They're extremely rare, yes. So wow. It was a really, really neat experience.
So what types of things are you seeing in these stranded animals?
Well, you know, it varies. A lot of those animals, we do not see hearing loss. So we suspect that the stranding was caused by something other than an exposure to sound. It can be a disease. It can be just age. You have a lot of calves that strand if they get separated from mom, especially during humpback whale season. So there's a variety of factors.
And you see a variety of species as well, right?
Correct. Yeah, I work with a wide array of species.
Okay, so you got beaked whales, which I'm pretty jealous to hear about. That's pretty rare. But what else do you see?
In Hawaii, mm-hmm. We've had... that's a tough question. I have to think about it for a second. Pygmy killer whales. We've had Piponocephala, which is the... I'm blanking on the common name right now. We had spotted dolphins. We have spinner dolphins, obviously. But we don't always get a chance to work with them. Some of those animals die before we get a chance to do some tests.
Okay. And... you get to work with live animals as well, though.
Correct.
So yes. It's not all just stranded animals.
No.
And in terms of strandings, this is obviously an issue. What can people do if they see an animal strand or to help prevent strandings?
Well, I think people have to remember that these animals are protected by federal law. There is the Marine Mammal Protection Act. There is the Endangered Species Act. So whenever you see a marine mammal that strands, you should call the authorities. That's the first thing you should do. Just like for monk seals, call the authorities and ask them what can be done. I think that's the most important part of what people can do to help.
And what's the best part of your job? I mean, you do so many different things and work with such a unique species of animals.
Well, I think, you know, we're very fortunate. We do get to work with a variety of species. I'm going next week to work with beluga whales, and it's just fun. And we get to work with local agencies, volunteers, interns, and students. So the variety is probably the best part of this job.
So beluga whales, I'm guessing, won't be in Hawaii then.
No, surprisingly, it's in Spain. So it's still warm weather. It will be at a park over there. In Valencia.
And is it the first time you're going to be working with beluga whales?
No, it's the second time.
Okay.
Yes.
And do you have a personal favorite species to work with?
I'm going to have to say the false killer whale. We have a false killer whale at the Marine Mammal Research Program, and she's an incredible animal to work with.
So can you, I mean, a false killer whale, is that like a fake orca? Can you like describe what a false killer whale looks like?
Certainly. For the people who are familiar with pilot whales, they're about 5 to 6 meters in length, black, all black. They don't have a rostrum. They don't have a beak. They actually got put on the Endangered Species Act. So the insular stock of the main Hawaiian island population just got added to the ESA. And it's a small population. They're known in Hawaii to share their food. So it's a really cool species to work with.
Excellent. And I have to ask, because we are honoring World Oceans Day today, how are you going to be honoring the ocean?
Well, I just found out that the Honolulu Museum of Art is going to have a lot of activities. And one of them is a movie by one of my friends, Julie Gauthier, and it's called Narcosis. And it's about free diving. And I'm really looking forward to seeing that.
That sounds great. I know they're doing a bunch of World Ocean Day events, not only at the Honolulu Museum of Art. I know the NOAA Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale Sanctuary is going to be doing an event at Turtle Bay for families, and I think there is a variety of events happening. So hopefully everybody will get out there and do something to honor our oceans.
Sounds great.
Ode, it's been an honor to have you on the show, and thank you so much for sharing about your research. I can't wait to hear about how your experience goes with the beluga whales.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Stay tuned, because we're going to be talking corals with Jonathan Burns, who's calling in from Hilo after this traffic break. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors: D.R. Horton Schuler Homes, University of Hawaii Federal Credit Union, R&R Solar Supply, Hank's Taxi Service.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
A reminder, the exit ramp from Fort Weaver Road southbound that loops around to Farrington Highway eastbound is going to be closed tonight from 10 p.m. until 4 tomorrow morning. We've got the typical slowdowns going west to the stadium, but if you're coming into town from the west, expect slower than usual traffic. It's backed up on both freeways at the Middle Street merge because of that earlier accident before the Punahou exit. It has been cleared. Normal traffic to the windward side and Hawaii Kai.
Aloha. Hawaii's Tomorrow and Jeff Davis are looking for motivated people. Are you a writer? The Solar Guy could use some comedy. Would you like to intern? You know he's got room, so give Jeff a call. Jeff Davis at 554-7200. 554-7200.
Aloha nohoi kako and ho mai kai nohoi praise to Jeff Davis.
You're terrible at this.
I'm terrible.
I love you, Ruby. Aloha. Hi, it's Jeff. Aloha. It seems as though Hawaiian Electric has made their decision to slow down photovoltaic solar electric installation throughout this last tax season. Many people have turned to battery storage systems to save money on the upgrades and to beat the tax season. These battery storage systems are standalone. You're not connected to the grid. You do receive this year's tax credits for them, and you can install them in any area on the island at any time. It's a fantastic idea. Now, I'm Kamiyama Solar, and we've installed many of these systems in the past. If you have any questions for me, they can be answered generically with a phone call. So go ahead and get to me, Jeff Davis, your solar guy, regarding battery storage systems for your photovoltaics this year at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. Aloha!
Aloha! It's me, Braden DeVos. And again, I ask a favor. Will you help restock the fish on our reefs so when my friends and I go snorkeling, we can see Hawaii as it should be? Mahalo. Thank you, Solar Guy.
Welcome back to the show. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. With us now is Jonathan Burns, a PhD candidate in the zoology department at the University of Hawaii. Now, John's calling in all the way from Big Island. Are you there, John?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, perfectly. Thanks so much for calling in.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So you are doing some really interesting work studying coral health and disease. So I'm curious to know, we talked a little bit about corals earlier, but how do corals get sick?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So corals are a really interesting organism in the sense that they're an animal, but then they also depend on algae that live inside of them, as well as a bunch of bacteria and other microorganisms. So each colony itself almost creates this like really complex little community that if any parts of that change, right, the whole system can start to sort of be affected, essentially. So because they're an animal, just like us, they have immune systems, and essentially as they can start to get stressed out from their environment, say the temperature is too hot or a bunch of sediment or pollutants is going out on the reef, just like for ourselves, if we had a crazy week and we're, you know, staying up late at night and we can't sleep, all those stressors start to combine. It starts to affect your immunity, and corals, just like us, to get diseases. And it's not too surprising in the sense that almost every animal population has, you know, a baseline level of disease. It's unheard of for no animals to basically have any diseases. So it's expected, but with all the changes occurring in the oceans right now and a lot of, you know, stressors that are building up, we want to keep tabs on it and make sure that there's not massive disease outbreaks that might wipe out, you know, huge populations of coral.
And we've been seeing a lot more of that, I think, in the news here, even in Hawaii. You know, there's been mention of disease outbreaks in Kauai and all kinds of places. Are you looking at any of these specific disease outbreaks?
Yeah, I mean, the coral health community, they're all, it's a small group, even though it's a lot of people around the world. Everyone does a fantastic job of keeping in touch and sharing stories and research findings. And so, yeah, the last few decades, you know, seen really big outbreaks, especially in the Caribbean. Luckily, the Indo-Pacific and Hawaii has done quite well comparatively, but the outbreak events like you're talking about in Kauai, those are some really scary situations, which just gives us a little bit more motivation to keep track and keep monitoring all the sites we're looking at now. because the reality is it's a huge coastline. You know, just here on the Big Island, we have a massive coastline, and these reefs cover a really large area. We can't look at every single place at once. We just don't have the manpower or the ability. But knowing that these outbreaks are occurring and that they have the potential to occur, it just means everywhere we're looking, we need to be really careful and get all eyes out there that we can.
So now I know there are a lot of coral doctors that are studying corals, but in terms of corals getting sick, you know, can they survive? I mean, there's no coral, like, veterinarian per se.
Yeah, the stethoscopes are a little bit ineffective underwater, but they can survive. You know, they have that basic immune function like I talked about, and corals by their nature are resilient to some degree. So they handle a lot of stressors. They handle fluctuations. I think what typically pushes them to the point of no return is just when you have so many factors bearing down on them that it's just too much. They're not able to get the energy they need to respond or recover from, say, what might be an acute event of disease, and it'll then become chronic, and the whole colony or an entire community of corals could die.
So we often focus a lot on Oahu on the show. What about over on Big Island? What are you seeing in the corals over there?
You know, that's a really good question. Compared to Oahu, we don't see a lot of the large-scale, you know, impacts that have occurred, say, along Waikiki. You know, there's a lot of areas that were thriving reefs on Oahu, and through a lot of anthropogenic impacts, development, changes to the coastline, a lot of those reefs have disappeared. So knowing that that's a possibility, it's nice on the Big Island that we're sort of in the past a little bit. We haven't had that large development. So in some degree, a lot of the corals and the reefs are very healthy, but there are still areas that we see a lot of disease. And in a way, it's a really exciting situation, because where we see these diseases manifest and there aren't so many factors bearing down, in some ways we've got a good chance to kind of isolate these different parameters that might be causing those specific diseases. And while it's still low levels, you know, there's definitely areas where they're impacted, which just makes us wonder why. You know, and I've been on a cruise with you. We were all the way in the middle of the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, and we saw a lot of diseases in French Frigate Shoals. So, you know, sometimes even the most isolated reefs can still get sick.
And in looking at these diseases that you're studying, how do you do that? Like, how do you assess if a coral is healthy or a coral is sick?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So a lot of it is just becoming familiar with your corals and spending a lot of time underwater. You know, observation is a really powerful tool, and there's no supplement for just doing a lot of surveys and beginning to recognize what are maybe general interactions between reefs, typical responses that you might see, and what's something that's alarming. And as you get to learn them better and better, you become quite keen at recognizing, okay, that's a specific disease, or this is just a stress response, or these are just two colonies fighting for space. And what we do then is, once we're knowledgeable of those different conditions, we just characterize them as much as we can, just like you would do in a human population. So if there was an outbreak of a disease in Honolulu, you would want to go interview people, just like we have these little interviews with the corals when we do the surveys, and you'd want to know a lot of things about them. You know, how old are you? Where do you live? What gender are you? And we can kind of ask corals, or not the same, can't ask them the same questions, but we can get similar information. What species are you? How large are you? Where on the reef are they located? How dense is the population? And we hope to get little clues by finding these cofactors that might be driving disease in certain areas.
That's fascinating. John, I want you to hold on here, because we have a question from just Jeff Davis, who normally hosts this show, about the research that you're doing in some of the corals. Jeff, are you on the air with us?
I am, and I'm so happy to hear you talking about one of my favorite topics. Aloha to you and your guest today, Carly.
Aloha, Jeff.
I'm under the impression you're going to be headed out to sea and be doing some live broadcast from the research vessel.
That's right, yes. I'm going to be going out next week, and for some of July, and we'll be actually broadcasting live from Station Aloha.
I appreciate that. I've done a lot of work with the water column studies out there and the absorption of CO2 and acidity. It's great stuff, and I wanted to throw this out to your guest this Friday. Day after tomorrow, I'm going to be having a fellow in from Georgia whose forte is radar, Doppler radar, interference radar, bouncing off clouds and getting back into the reef. This fellow claims that in any major area where they've got major radar, whether it be military as embarking sounds or just your typical weather or air flight stuff, that he's seen a huge correlation in disease such as Kaneohe Bay, Kauai, Florida, 80% coral die-off, Guam. I'm curious about this. Has your guest had any experience in the idea that this radar, which is, sends out millions of watts of pulses, is designed to bounce off things, and the small amount that bounces back to the radar device and tells us where the cloud is or the plane is, the majority of it's going somewhere we don't know, including back into our oceans. And does he have any background in that, Cardi?
I don't know. John, you want to take that question?
Yeah, why not? That's a really good question. And my first response would be anything can happen. So it's definitely worthy to be alarmed of something like that. There's a real big international forum online called Coralist, and it's funny you ask that because that question has just recently popped up, and people have been asking about what are these impacts that these sonar or other devices might.
Well, yeah, John, and the most obvious thing, John, is when the Navy publishes paper says we're going to kill this many whales, this many dolphins, this many turtles, we admittedly are going to destroy these mammals because we're going to be putting sound waves underwater. They're going to spatially interrupt them, tear their eardrums, make them not be able to feed, send them up on the beaches like whales. This underwater stuff is admittedly bad for living things such as a coral polyp, I would presume. But now here we got these other guys saying it's a combination that this incredible radar pulse that occurs every second is intended, the majority of the power, by all means, goes other places. And if that stuff goes back underwater, blah, 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 then have you seen any hard science on this? I guess my question.
No,
I got my
no.
guest coming in. On Friday, we'll have this fellow.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen any hard science. And so that's where I would say the second part is, it's a great question. It's always worth asking. It's worth an investigation. But you have to be careful with just visual correlations as well. You know, there's a lot of amazing correlations out there that make no sense.
I agree.
For instance, true story, ice cream consumption leads to murder. So as ice cream consumption has gone up over the last few years, murder has almost followed it exactly. So while it's interesting to note that people may be seeing these things in relation to impacts to the reef, as scientists, I think the best thing we can do is be objective and then try and investigate it and see, are these actual causal relationships or is it just randomly associated?
And yeah, well, again, this guy's got a big website. I'll let you guys get back to your show.
Yeah.
Carly, thanks. Tomorrow I'm doing Habilitat rehabilitation and as well as drug rehabilitation as well as homeless issues. And then Friday, like I said, I'll be doing part of my show on this science that says these big radar systems are causing major marine meltdowns in ecosystems where they are located, etc. John, if you're interested, listen to the show.
Thanks for calling, Jeff.
Yeah.
Carly, have fun out in the middle of the ocean. I'm so jealous.
Will do. Take care.
Aloha.
So, John, don't go away because I have a few more questions for you.
Awesome.
I mean, what's the age old saying? Correlation is not always causation. Is that how it goes?
Yeah, exactly.
Something along those lines. Well, definitely an interesting idea to think about.
Yeah.
But I'm really curious about some more of the research that you're doing, not just in Hawaii Island, but you were also recently selected as a finalist for the Rolex Awards for Enterprise, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So can you tell us a little bit about this award? I'm going to sort of make you talk about it.
Yeah, no problem. I can do that. So one thing to begin with that, I guess with a lot of the research I do, you know, I just find it's kind of easy as scientists, we can go down a real narrow focus and get really sort of one-track mind where we want to go into a place, we want to get these results. And that's great. That's what drives a lot of research. But I really believe that if you step back, you need to look at the bigger picture. Well, what is our work doing that can actually benefit this place and the people that depend on these resources? And I've been working with a few people. One of them is my brother-in-law, who's an engineer, and they've been developing these tablet applications where you can essentially collect a bunch of data real-time. You can create any customized data form you want. So you're able to record an array of information, and then real-time, it can just be wirelessly synced to a database. And you know, a lot of the sites I've worked with, especially here on the Big Island,
we've tried to have really close ties to the community and share our findings with them, but many times they have a whole world of knowledge that's incredible, and a lot of it's just because they're so immersed in these environments. And so they understand them on a scale that many times we haven't even thought about. And I just thought it'd be amazing if we could equip them with tools that let them monitor these environments and actually get data that they can use. Because right now, many times they're getting anecdotal information, but if they say go to a policy meeting, it's difficult without real evidence in the manner of data. They're sometimes a little powerless to make these change. So I thought it'd be awesome if we could give them this tool where they can monitor their environments, and if they're seeing decline, say in a fishery, or they're seeing an increase in invasive algae, they can take photos, they can record it, they can timestamp it, and we kind of streamline that process, store it in a database, and then they have that. They have that data. They can go to meetings and say, no, look, these changes are happening in our environments. We need to do something about it. And that's kind of the project in a nutshell.
And have these tablets been tried out in the community before, or are you worried about taking electronic tablets out into the ocean?
Yeah, that's a good question again. We've had success with a few different waterproof housings or dry bags that we can put the tablets in that still keep them functional, and we have been trying it out. I've been working a lot with a really good friend of mine, Kehal Springer. She's with Conservation International. And so we've been doing some pilot projects for their Opihi and their intertidal surveys. And so far it's been really successful, because one huge reality for us as scientists as well is we go out and we get this data, and then we have to spend hours typing it all back into the computer. And, you know, nobody loves doing all that busy work. It's just not fun at all. And it can be a huge problem, though, in the community setting where maybe they don't have a bunch of computers and resources to get all these data sheets and people to pay to enter all that data. And so they've loved it with the tablet, where we can build the forms for them based on whatever they want to survey, and they can collect that data, and it's just automatically uploaded as soon as they have wireless internet.
And how's your experience been working with the community? Are they excited to participate? Are they sort of intimidated by, you know, doing quote-unquote science?
Yeah, I mean, all of that comes into play. And I think what makes this adaptable is that we can design data forms for their interest. So we don't have to go in and say, hey, this is our project, this is what we're interested in, will you collect information that benefits us? It's really about them, and it's about the place. And we're all ultimately working together to conserve these ecosystems. So every angle that we can work together at, you know, and bring that information into one place is beneficial. And I think as long as they see that you're really honestly trying to help them and trying to help the place, they're usually really on board, and they give us phenomenal feedback. You know, many times they notice inconsistency in the data forms or problems with the way we've set it up that we've totally missed. And you know, bringing people together and collaborating, it always produces a better product.
And so the Rolex Award, when do you find out about the results of that?
So we should find out. I think they announced at the end of this month. And that would be amazing if we get pushed to that next level, give us a huge boost of funds to really kickstart it. But I kind of want to focus on every way we can move forward. So Conservation International has been amazing. That they're really interested in helping to push the project forward, and there's a lot of different groups that have been interested. So regardless of the outcome, you know, I feel like we're onto a real good idea that can have some great outcome, and we're just going to try to do everything we can to make it happen.
And I mean, this is just a big honor to be nominated. I mean, this is a very, very big award. Do you know how many people entered or how many finalists there are?
Yeah, there was a few thousand that entered, and they narrowed it down to, I'm not sure how many of us interviewed. It was a pretty crazy process. You know, Rolex, they're high rollers. So
no pun there.
Yeah. So they, you know, flew us out for interviews and asked a lot of questions, and it was intense. It was very different from what you're used to in the science realm and, you know, low-budget grant situation. So it was a learning experience, and then they, from all those different rounds of interviews and questioning, they narrowed it down to, I think, 22 finalists. So it's been a huge honor. I'm so thankful to them. You know, it's such a great award, and it really enables us to pursue these projects that are really outside the box from what we normally do, but can still have a really great benefit to the environments that we work in.
Well, it's so nice to see you taking an active role in marine science and conservation. How do you encourage conservation attitude in the communities that you work in?
You know, I just think everything is connected. Everything. So believing that we can have an impact that can also be positive is really important, because
just in our homes, there's things that we can do that are going to have a positive impact on the ocean. And when I talked about coral disease, I was mentioning local stressors all the way up to global stressors. And it's easy to see the global stressors and throw your arms up and say, okay, there's nothing we can do. But just in your home, there's things that you have that might run off and reach the ocean. There's an amount of trash that you compile. There's watersheds nearby that you can volunteer in to clear out invasive species and replant native species. I mean, I could go on all night. I know there's a time limit, so I better stop. But recognizing that everything on land is connected to everything in the ocean will help you realize that almost everywhere you look, everything you see in your daily life, like there's something you can do to have a positive outcome for those environments. So it's a little bit of a vague answer, but there's always something to be done.
And that is a perfect message for World Ocean Day. So I have to ask, because we're going with this theme today, how are you going to celebrate World Ocean Day, John?
Which is tomorrow, right? Or today?
It's the 8th. It's this weekend.
Oh, yeah. So that, well, you see, for me, every day is Ocean Day.
There you go.
You know, just get out there. A good friend of mine, Kale Lopes, is throwing a stand. It's a Science and New Discoveries, a camp for high schoolers to get involved in becoming the future marine stewards in Hawaii, and I'm probably going to try help him as much as I can over the weekend between his two segments. And if anyone's interested, please feel free to contact you or me. I can put them in touch with Kale. We need people to help out with these high school camps. So, yeah, that's a great way to help us with Ocean Day.
Awesome. Thanks so much for taking some time to talk with us, John, and I hope you have a fantastic World Ocean Day.
I will. Yeah, I hope you do as well. Thanks so much for having me on. It's a real honor.
Thanks, John. And before we wrap up today, I am going to bring a little ocean interesting story to all of you for World Ocean Day. And I'm going to put Dr. Megan Donahue on the spot here a little bit. In the break, she was talking about spawn aggregation and this new research that she is doing with that. And I was curious, first, what spawn aggregation is and how you would study something like that.
Yeah, so spawning aggregations are really interesting. So some fish that basically they have to all find each other in the ocean in order to reproduce. And so certain times of year and certain locations, they all kind of mysteriously show up at the same time, at the same place in order to reproduce. And there's often lots of, I'm sure if you went on YouTube and looked up spawning aggregation, there's all kinds of cool little like fishy dances they do when they're actually doing the spawning.
I'll be doing that tonight, by the way.
That's and there, it's really interesting. So this kind of, you know, what a biologist would call a life history strategy, it's like a way of making a living in the ocean, is super interesting. It also, as you might imagine, makes them really susceptible to fishing pressure, because if all the fish come together in one place, then it's really easy to target them. So there's a lot of conservation around these spawning aggregations as well. So we have a project looking at a particular species of snapper in around Cuba, and so we're looking at how those species kind of focus on like, How do they find the right place to do this spawning aggregation? Is it, and what we've found is that in some places they actually have they've adjusted their spawning aggregation to take advantage of the ocean currents to increase their reproductive success, increase the number of babies that they make that get successfully back to shore. So it's a really interesting kind of thing to look at. If you see it, I mean, it's a really exciting thing to see, but it's also a really fascinating biological process to study.
Wow, smart spawning. I like that.
That's right.
Well, from smart spawning to coral disease, the ocean has so many interesting things for us. I want to remind our listeners to take some time this weekend to celebrate and honor oceans for World Ocean Day, which is Sunday, June 8th. But in reality, every day should be World Ocean Day. I want to thank all of our guests who could join us today. And for more information or to listen to our podcast, please check out the website www.cosi-ie.net. I would like to give a special thank you to Jeff Davis, COSI Island Earth, and the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. COSI stands for Centers for Ocean Science, Education Excellence, and is an NSF-funded program. I'm Carly Weiner. Thanks for listening. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.